it's so important to run candidates that adhere to principle. Because if you get that 1% based for the right reason, that's better than 4% for the wrong reason. I mean, if you run like a Republican campaign, a Republican platform, or a Democratic platform that's antithetical to liberty, and you get 4 or 5%, what have you accomplished? You haven't accomplished anything. But if you get 1% based on true principles of our party, that's your base that you build on to go from there and hopefully skyrocket by building a base of principled candidates and people and members.
That was Jacob Hornberger, founder of the Future of Freedom Foundation and current front runner in the race to be the Libertarian Party presidential nominee, speaking at an LP debate Saturday night in the wake of Congressman Justin Amash exiting the campaign. Howdy, folks. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I am Matt Welch, joined by the senior Reason Brain Trust of Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi, gang.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt. Maybe
Happy Monday, everyone.
We should call this podcast the Senior Moments Podcast, then, Matt. If we're...
That's you and me doing the breakaway one.
Yeah.
The split off. Yes,
Peter and I are happy to let y'all go off into the retirement home and do Reason Senior Moments.
Yeah, before we...
But only with safe quarantine procedures.
Yeah, don't actually go to retirement homes right now.
When we forget to turn the recording off, it's like...
It'll all be like Al Kaline jokes. All right, so one of our... RIP Al Kaline. Sorry about that. One of our beloved listeners was complaining on Twitter recently that we talked too much about Justin Amash's presidential candidacy on this podcast.
That ends today, Matt Welch.
That ends today, old guy on the balcony. So just 18 days after finally getting off the fence and joining the LP presidential race, less than 1 week before delegates were scheduled to begin voting online, there's an asterisk implied with that we'll get to later. And 6 hours before he was supposed to join the aforementioned LP debate, which I moderated, the congressman tweeted at that, after much reflection, I've concluded that circumstances don't lend themselves to my success as a candidate for president this year, and therefore I will not be a candidate. He just tweeted it out. We've been following Amash's Hamlet act here for years. Catherine, you interviewed him back in January 2019, which I think was 2 or 3 centuries ago. And he looked like one of those bulls that's behind the gate at the rodeo thing, you know. So to quote the about running, it looked like he was going to run. He was like he thought about it. He was all like fired
it's
up.
It's true. And I was out there.
His testicles there, Matt, or something.
I was just going to go with the red cape. I was going to go a nice direction with this. All right, fine.
So
you know what? There is a madman running for president and a madman in office. The time for niceties is over.
Thank you. To quote Fred Willard, the late great, Catherine, what happened? And also, what do you want to tell the congressman now that he is binging podcasts instead of debating Vermin Supreme?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that he sort of warned us about right from the very, very beginning. Amash has said, and I have repeated on this podcast, that he doesn't want to run for an office he doesn't think he can win. And despite my long history in getting in trouble for saying this, I will say again that it is very, very unlikely, vanishingly unlikely, that a libertarian will win the presidency in 2020. And I think you can hear that in the debate that you moderated, where the talk was about getting a fraction of a percent versus getting a single digit percentage in the national election. That is where the party is right now. And if you believe Amash's own words that he doesn't want to run for an office that he doesn't think he can win, then it is not surprising that he is now not running for an office that he can't win. But I'm bummed. I was not going to vote, of course, but I was happy for my colleagues who were going to have an opportunity to vote for someone that they kind of liked. And they may still have that opportunity since there are plenty of other libertarian candidates in the field. But there was a certain jazziness around Amash, a certain energy, and now that is departing the field. So RIP Amash, and I hope he's listening to this podcast, in which case I say enjoy your retirement, buddy.
Nick, you interviewed him shortly after he announced. How are you feeling emotionally?
Well, you know, independent of him, I'm feeling pretty crappy anyway. But this is just one more thing. I mean, you know, why is everybody against me? I don't know, you know. The Amash withdrawal, for me, when I think about the presidential race, it has two major effects in my corner of the world. And the first is on the national race. I think, you know, it leaves us now with a field that is, you know, we're back to Dracula versus the Wolfman. I mean, like, who the hell do you vote for?
That sounds even a lot cooler than the reality.
Yeah, no, that's true. Then, like, the mummy and the mummy's grandfather, right?
Like, Dracula 2020, absolutely over the current field.
Yes, but...
Oh, no. Totally Team Wolfman. No.
In any case... The national conversation now will be, you know, it's Trump versus Biden, and there isn't even, and this is the difference between somebody who has signed off on, you know, whatever it is now, what are we calling it, $3 trillion or $5 trillion spent on coronavirus during Trump?
Three so far.
Okay, so versus that, versus Biden saying, you know what, we're going to pull out all the stops and we haven't even gotten started yet in terms of radically transforming every goddamn aspect of the government and the government's reach on stuff. So there's that, which is terrible. There's no third party in the national debate. And then within the Libertarian Party, it almost saps all of my interest in the LP in the presidential election year, because it has now changed from the idea that the Libertarian Party could have candidates who are actually serious about running for and winning and holding office. Not that Amash was going to win, but that he would make inroads, because he could get 4, 5, or 10%, especially in a race like this, and radically alter the way we think about politics and political parties. Now it is going to be a debate over which libertarian is running for purity king. I mean, I feel like I'm in junior high and we're talking about abstinence only education, sex education or something. It's about purity suddenly. And, you know, we already have a vast archipelago of think tanks and publications and other nonprofit organizations to talk about what libertarianism is. The LP should be a political party that's interested in actually running and winning in elections. And it's not now. It's going to be a catechism about, no, you know, the CIA, not only should it be disbanded, but everybody in it should be shot and killed and incinerated, put back together and then shot and killed again. It's drained it of interest for me.
We're going to talk more about the Biden and coronavirus response later. But Suderman, you reacted on Slack, and I always like to snitch you, that it seemed.
What did I say? I have no idea what I said.
You said something along the lines referring to Jacob Hornberger's quote that began this podcast of saying that it would be better to get 1% of the vote with a principal campaign than 4% with just another ex-Republican campaign.
And let's be clear, it's better to get like 2/10 of what, I mean, the COVID-19 is going to have a higher infection fatality rate than, you know, the Libertarian Party is going to have in this presidential election right now.
Wow. I think.
Go, Peter.
Too soon? I'm going to go with too soon.
Nope, never. Yeah, what do you think, what do you make of a leading candidate of a party saying that 1% could very well be better than 4%.
I just don't know whether the LP or COVID-19 is a bigger public health menace. And I think that's the debate we need to have. I think it's the wrong way to think about what political parties are supposed to do. Like Nick said, there are plenty of institutions that exist to debate, outline, and explain what libertarianism is at its most pure. But that's not the place of political parties. Political parties are about assembling coalitions, sometimes with compromise, often with compromise, often with groups of people who disagree with each other and are sort of not on the same page about every single thing. Their job is to assemble coalitions and then try to get people to vote for them and try to win elections. And it's really telling that the LP, a leading candidate for the Libertarian Party nominee for president, is saying, we shouldn't do that. we should not try to win elections. Instead, we should simply try to be a messaging organization that exists for ideological purity purposes and explanation only. And, you know, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but libertarians hate messaging votes in Congress. They hate, like, as a general rule, Congress doing a bunch of stuff that's just purely symbolic just to get the message across, because that's not what our elected officials are supposed to do. I'm sure there's probably an exception, but in general, you look at that sort of thing, and we are going to when we talk about the next coronavirus response bill, and libertarians look at that and say that's just a symbolic, like, exercise in time wasting. That's dumb politics. It's a bad way to go about doing business. And I think it's even worse when that's your theory of not just not winning elections, but going out of your way to lose them even more than you would otherwise.
Let me play devil's advocate, though, because I do think that this has been something that's, like, baked into the Libertarian Party from the beginning, this sense of itself not just as a conventional political party in the sense that we understand Democrats and Republicans to be, but also as an educational organization, also as an advocacy group. And there is a certain segment of the American public that doesn't pay attention to discourse about ideas. They just don't. They're not like, what do think tanks think? They're not like, what does this latest essay in The Atlantic tell me about the world? They are interested in the realities of electoral politics. And, you know, I know just from my micro sample that, you know, the various boomers in my life said to me some variation of, like, hey, are you excited about this Amish fella? Because they know I'm a libertarian and they care about politics, or they have access to politics through elections. And so I think there's at least a case to be made for the Libertarian Party to do this thing, this sort of hybrid partisan and advocacy thing, because that's a vector for advocacy. And it's not how I would spend my life. It obviously isn't how I have chosen to spend my life or even my political life, but I don't think it's bananas.
So I think that there is some truth to what you're saying about how political parties conduct themselves. And if you look at what the Democratic race was this year, it was a race that was in part about defining what it meant to be a Democrat. And so I've got this piece in the new issue, right? And we've talked about this, is that, you know, it started and ended as an argument between Joe Biden's theory of what it means to be a Democrat and Bernie Sanders' theory of what it means to be a Democrat. And that is a reasonable way to use electoral politics, is to kind of have an argument about what you are and what you mean. But both of them were arguing that their theory of what it meant to be a Democrat would win more votes. And that's the difference here. They, like, the LP argument that we are now hearing is we should be more libertarian at the expense of votes. And that, I think, is the big difference and the thing, the place where the argument has really gone wrong.
I want to back Peter up on that a little bit. And, you know, Catherine, it's telling that they didn't say, you know, what was the guy's name, Matt? John Mons?
John Mons, yeah.
Yeah, they didn't say, like, oh, that John Mons character, well, he sounds fascinating, Catherine. Are you excited about him? They said Justin Amash, who's a sitting member of Congress. You know, it's like, and Gary Johnson, bless his heart, and in the debate, Judge Jim Gray, who was his vice presidential candidate in 2012 and is running with Larry Sharp, who had a relatively successful LP run for governor of New York. These are people who are actually engaging in politics as Libertarian Party candidates for stuff. And again, the LP, I'm not a member. So, you know, my criticism can be taken as, you know, just, you know, outsider telling people what to do. But it's, you know, a political party, you don't form a political party, it seems to me, in order to make sure you have absolutely no effect on politics.
I mentioned before a kind of asterisk in thinking about their unprecedented online only voting process for the presidential and vice presidential nomination, which is scheduled to begin on Friday of this week. So just four days from now. The asterisk is this, behind the scenes, and this is all part of the debate in the context of Amash's announcements, which he referred to in the bottom of his tweet storm about it. The Libertarian Party is kind of in a state of chaos. Here's a tweet from a, I believe, former Libertarian National Committee member, LNC, certainly a candidate who got, I think, 10% of the vote in Wisconsin for Congress or something like that. Andy Craig, who now works at Cato, when reacting to someone saying, hey, what do you think about Amash stepping down? His reaction was, the LNC is a toxic dumpster fire and most of them should resign. There's a whole thing and it's too complicated and arcane to get into, but the way that the National Committee dealt with the contingency planning for their convention, which is originally scheduled to happen May 21st to May 25th, they still kind of don't fully know how they're going to do all of this stuff. And there are a lot of last minute endless meetings and last minute proposals thrown up and bad faith argumentation and people threatening to resign en masse. It is a mess right now. And so we think that it's going to be handled online only through this process of instant runoff voting and other technological things that they've never really tried before. There's still an outside chance that the whole shebang gets delayed until July, which would have impact on ballot access rules. It's just kind of amazing to see how many ways that they've messed up. Catherine, I want to form this into kind of a question, which is that, and Nick mentioned Larry Sharp, who ran a very aggressive campaign and raised nearly $500,000 here, but also as to be governor of New York in 2018, but also finished in fourth place with like 1.2% of the vote. I was behind the green there. There's been, if you look, starting with Mark Sanford, who's a good friend of Justin Amash, starting with him getting bounced in 2018 as an incumbent in his own primary, there has been that Sanford thing right there. You had Larry Sharp's disappointing, relatively, results of a otherwise well-run campaign. Gary Johnson only getting 15% of the vote in his home state, running for Senate against an absolute nobody Republican. You had the Three Stooges in 2019 and 2020, as christened by Donald Trump, Bill Weld, the former vice presidential nominee, Sanford again, and Joe Walsh, who all came up with, not the guitar player, who all came up with varying levels of a kind of libertarian-ish or adjacent argument against Donald Trump. And now you have the rise and fall of Amash. It's roadkill out here, Catherine, is it not, for people who campaign saying stuff like, hey, we're spending too much money, we should knock it off and we should be more constitutional?
Yep. Yeah, it's bad. There is, despite the fact that we are spending more money than ever and that the interference of government in our lives, even before coronavirus and certainly now during coronavirus, is at all-time highs on almost any measure, except for, I suppose, how you conduct your private life and to some extent your personal recreational drug use. There is no audience for this, and it's certainly giving me, you know, weekly existential crises. I'm not surprised that it's giving the Libertarian Party periodic existential crises as well. And I do think that there is still an instinctive and American response to spending all this money and such an intrusive state, and that it is there and it is available to be tapped, but it is right now being tapped for use in the kind of MAGA hat culture war rather than in the policy making or budget discussing sphere. And I don't quite know how to steer it back. And I, at least from what I've heard of Libertarian Party candidates in recent years, I don't think they do either. And it sucks. I don't know. Not to be such a downer. I do think, I mean, your description of the state of the LP right now vis-a-vis coronavirus is also the state of me right now vis-a-vis coronavirus. Like, my inability to think about what June is going to look like is deeply troubling to a person like me who really likes to make plans and have them and stick with them and go forward in a predictable environment. You know, this, like, this is how political parties should conduct themselves. They should have long-range plans. They should plan for contingencies. We have certainly seen in the White House, they are not doing that and can't do that. Even in the, you know, the Joe Biden campaign, like, who has seen that guy in months? We don't know where he is.
Yeah, I think so, we need some proof of life on
we do.
Biden,
like, if we could just get a shot of Biden holding today's New York Times, that would be great. And also on a personal level, that's where I am. So I guess I, again, am feeling like soft-hearted toward the shambles of the LP because we're all a bit shambolic at the moment.
I like the idea of them doing everything online, you know, and taking the bull by the horns. Matt, that the voting is for delegates only, right?
Correct. There's about 1,000 delegates. Their primaries and caucuses, of which they've held nearly a dozen, are all non-binding.
Right. So I mean, I love the idea of that, and I like the idea that the LP would be, you know, doing that kind of stuff. And you know, I just despair of the way that things are going there. You know, what the LP can add that other groups can't is some kind of presence in actual votes and elections and things like that. And I feel like they're letting down. To go to Catherine's, kind of gloominess, you know, obviously it's completely understandable. By the same token, I see, the response of the government now, and we're, you know, what are we, 2 months really into like a hardcore lockdown, you're already starting to see the fraying of stuff. People understand on some level that, you know, most of what we're doing is an overreaction or misdirected. Just the way that, you know, the FDA just shut down this small pilot test of a test that was being administered by a local group in Seattle, because it contravened, you know, a regulatory structure put in place by the FDA. People are getting fed up with this. They recognize that the FDA and the CDC screwed up, and that's not about Trump. These are lifer agencies that just have failed. They either, like the FDA, are a structural impediment to making our lives better by forcing drug companies to spend billions of dollars in order to bring anything to market. They're screwing things up now in the immediate time. The CDC was asleep at the switch. Trump is hollowing out. We need to go back and I think win the argument that what Trump is doing and the value from a libertarian point of view is he is demystifying power. We don't want people like this in charge. Obama over the weekend or last week in a speech to historically black colleges said as much, you know, that like what is becoming apparent is that the people who are in charge don't know what they're doing. And they're not even acting as if they're in charge. You can read that in a narrow partisan way, but most people aren't going to do that. It's like what's being revealed is why we need something radically different and very different. And I feel, you know, I feel confident like people are in their personal lives. Things are going pretty well because that's outside of politics. So it's dark. But I think, you know, as always, it's darkest right before the libertarian moment, Matt Welch.
As always.
Suderman, let's take this as an opportunity to transition fully into the major party response to the COVIDs. Feels like there's been a number of stories recently that can all be classified under the general heading of Democrats, you know, are going big against coronavirus. So let's use this as opportunity to transform the economy. There's a great headline, New York Times piece, I think last week or over the weekend, about the Biden campaign drawing in various Bernie economic planners seeking big Democratic ideas that make everything better. Can you update us on what the kind of latest state of play is on the next phase, $3 trillion Nancy Pelosi stimulus?
Yeah, so the big Democratic ideas that are going to make everything better turn out to be giving about $1 trillion to state and local governments to maybe, probably bail out their pension programs, and then also spending $25 billion bailing out the post office. Last week, the House Democrats spent most of the week putting together a $3 trillion. Yes, $3 trillion. So that would double the amount of spending that we've already done in response to this. More than double, actually, because we haven't spent quite $3 trillion so far. And this is a $3 trillion package, 1,800-page legislation that was basically didn't go through the committee process, had the most minimal amount of discussion and voting. And if there is there's anything like a hopeful sign in here, it was that Nancy Pelosi had trouble getting this passed in the House where she has a majority. There were actually a couple of Democratic defections throughout the process. It did end up passing, not with every Democratic vote, but basically along party lines. And one of the reasons why Pelosi had trouble getting this passed is because this bill is not going anywhere. Like I said earlier, the bill I was talking about when I was talking about messaging bills, this is entirely a messaging bill. And you just have to think of this as the opening volley in a partisan war over, you know, what the battle lines are going to be for the inevitable next COVID-19 relief package. And this is what Democrats are saying they want to do with it. They want to bail out states. They want to bail out the post office. They want to send everyone another $1,200 check, up to $6,000 per family, depending on your demographics, your income, et cetera, et cetera. And Republicans are saying, we're not ready to do that. And we're probably not going to do that exactly. But even Republicans who are saying, well, we don't want the bailout money for states to be used on pensions. You do have White House economic advisors saying things like, well, we're not inherently opposed to giving money to states. Just we don't want them to use it to cover their bad decisions that predate the coronavirus. And so this is the debate we're now having. I suspect that it will end up teeing up a big bill, probably not this big, but a big bill of some kind that will include some Republican priorities, perhaps things like infrastructure spending, which is something that Trump wants, perhaps the payroll tax holiday, which is something Trump's been talking about since the beginning of this, and almost certainly liability protections for businesses that reopen, which Mitch McConnell in the Senate, who is now kind of driving the next wave of the debate here, has said are a must have in any bill that comes through in the Senate.
Catherine, am I being juvenile? Okay, the answer is yes. When I, you know, see all these headlines about, like, you know, we need to really transform things now. Like, haven't we been transformed enough? I mean, feels like there hasn't been a lack of response here. It's just a question of whether any of it has been useful.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of warring impulses because, and this is something we've talked about from the beginning, from the beginning of the Trump administration, like, I remain confused and disoriented by my desire for stability and I think not just a sort of personal psychological desire, but a sort of principled and libertarian desire to have something like a government that you know what it's going to do tomorrow. And this is, you know, this is something that there's been, you know, infinite discourse on in the libertarian fandom, as they say, but that, you know, having no certainty about what's going to happen tomorrow is the most harmful thing for many, many kinds of private actors and private choices. And the thing that I found interesting in just the last few days is that rather than trying to radically transform society again, 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 through the actions of the state, through massive federal spending that trickles down to state governments or whatever it is that we're talking about, what's actually going to change our society in the next couple months is going to be private companies deciding to reopen. It's going to be individuals deciding to leave their houses and relax their rules or change how they're protecting themselves and others. And I think it's going to be a really cool and interesting case study in how little the closed period that we have gone through actually was down to state power and how much it was about individual choices. It was about people choosing to stay home. It was about companies choosing to close. We talked about this before, that many, 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 many firms shuttered before state orders to do so. And they're going to reopen before state permission to do so in a lot of cases. And so I guess I'm now kind of looking away from the state to transform society again for the fifth time in as many months and toward like NASCAR, just doing its NASCAR thing, and toward, but also toward Twitter saying maybe we're never going to have an office again in at all. Also toward.
Well, I think they're going to have an office. It's just that no one has to come to it.
Right. I mean, so I think that like it's not clear that everyone is going to choose open. It's not clear that everyone is going to choose outside in the park licking each other without masks on and then getting dinner at TGI Fridays. But people are making their own choices and companies are making their own choices. And it's like almost irrespective of what their governments are telling them to do, or certainly at least skirting the edges of that. So I was going to say I'm done looking to the government to transform society, but of course, we're never done with that.
I think there's, I agree with a lot of what you say, Catherine, but then there's a question of the idea that, okay, if we as individuals shut the economy down, what the hell were we thinking? Because we cratered the economy, we created a new depression, and then we're not going to come
scared.
Out of our spider holes. But yeah, I'm just saying like, you know, it is also really important to recognize that at various points, you know, Gavin Newsom shut down California, Andrew Cuomo shut down New York, et cetera. And it's more complicated than that, but it's also then what do we do with the wreckage? Because we're just screwed. I mean, this is it. We're going to live in a world where we're at 80% capacity or something. And that's not going to hold up very long.
Just anecdotally, one of my neighbors here, a great kind of, stoop hanging out neighborhood person who's lived here a long time, said to me, this is in Brooklyn, New York, that, you know, every time that she starts to think that she's sick of the way that New York is right now, if you live long enough, you stay long enough, it totally changes. Some external shock changes it. So, you know, she's sort of like anti-gentrification and stuff. So she was worried that it was getting too like corporate and Wall Street and yuppified here. Well, now the market's clearing and going in weird directions here. I mean, there's something like 420,000 residents of New York have gone.
Who's going to write the smoking hot, well, at least Times Square is back to the way it was before Giuliani take once the New York economy finishes collapsing?
What I'm excited about are 420,000 leaving New York essays.
No.
Oh, my God.
All published on Medium.
I was just about out of stuff to read.
Suderman, I want to get your reaction to an exchange over the weekend on 60 Minutes with Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, because I always like to sucker punch you. But he was asked by Scott Pelley, that's his name, right? Scott Pelley.
If you say so.
Yeah. Is it fair to say you simply flooded the system with money? Powell, yes, we did. That's another way to think about it. We did. Pelley, where does it come from? Do you just print it? Powell, we print it digitally. We can create money digitally, blah, 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 blah. We also print actual currency and distribute that through the reserve banks. Pelley, in terms of size, Mr. Chairman, how does what the Fed is doing right now compare to the unprecedented action it took in 2008? Powell, so the things we're doing now are substantially larger.
Mm-hmm.
And he says we're doing a multiple of the programs that were done during the last crisis and so on. So this is fine.gif, Peter, or is it that like... the libertarian complaints about the wheelbarrows full of inflation money and that the bond market's going to discipline us one of these years and whatever have been kind of wrong. Are we all modern monetary theorists now?
I do not think we are all modern monetary theorists now. Instead, what we all might be are market monetarists, kind of Milton Friedmanite monetary policy people who, and this is so we should talk about this in the context of what Congress is doing. And but also in the context of the Great Recession and the Great Depression. And if you go back to the Great Depression, for a long time, people thought that the big problem was just that the economy was totally broken and that like that we fixed it, you know, by doing a bunch of stuff in Congress and that it was, you know, it was our lawmakers and our presidents and World War II who saved this. And then Milton Friedman became in In some ways, he became Milton Friedman, the great Milton Friedman, by marshaling a huge amount of historical evidence that the real problem was that the Fed kept the money supply too tight. This is a little bit of a simplification of the explanation, but they basically, the Fed didn't do enough. The Fed was relatively new at that time, was like 15, 20 years old, something like that. And it just didn't want to step in and do what the Fed was supposed to do, which was try to keep things on an even keel. And so then in 2008 and 2009, when we had the Great Recession, the Fed did more. And there were some criticisms. Oh, this is going to cause inflation. This is going to be a huge problem. The Fed did a bunch more. It did all of these, you know, a couple of rounds of what were called quantitative easing. But this is basically the stuff that Milton Friedman said the Fed should have done in the Great Depression, which is to step in and buy bonds and create money and sort of manage the money supply in order to keep the economy relatively calm and on an even keel once again. And yet, if you look at Scott Sumner and David Beckworth, folks who have written about this, in some ways from some libertarian, you know, from a libertarian perspective, or at least one that is compatible with libertarian perspective, they will say that even in the Great Recession a decade or so ago, the Fed still didn't do enough. And I think that that is they have a quite strong story, I should say. And if they also we published just sort of as a footnote on this, they point to Canada. When Canada dropped its budget deficit, they cut a bunch of spending. But what they also did was some quantitative easing like stuff. They did a bunch of management and kind of it's kind of not quite money printing, but money management through the Fed. And now what the Fed has done has internalized those lessons and that criticism and is saying we are going to do what we can to try and solve this. And you can see that with in particular in the stock market. I am not going to say that I think that every single thing the Fed is doing here is definitely great. But there is a real argument to be made, even from a libertarian perspective, that the primary way that we should respond, that policymakers should respond to these sort of financial shocks is not by spending a bunch of money, but is instead by having the Fed play its role as the lender and bank of last resort. And that the Fed here is probably doing more to hold up the economy than any other single federal institution. And so I am not ready to go ahead, you know, to go forward here with a major criticism. I think there certainly are going to be libertarians who don't like this sort of thing. Historically, there have been. I do think we should be watchful. This is totally unprecedented and wildly outside of the realm of like what we have ever done before. And that alone is reason to be watchful and cautious and at least sort of like to maintain a critical eye here. But the Fed is playing its role. It's doing its part. And I think it is the Fed that is probably doing us the most good in Congress that is doing us a lot of harm here.
Catherine,
first off, the Fed has been pursuing an easy money policy for decades now. And I think the model that we should be looking at and be terrified is Japan. And this is something that we did. Reason talked about this in right around the financial crisis, that when Japan went into its lost decade, the government, both its central bank as well as its government, made sure that no businesses failed, that credit was everywhere, and they kept alive a bunch of zombie businesses. And we are doing exactly the same thing. And what you see is anemic to no growth and just a kind of limping along of a crappy economy. I think the lesson to take from the economic crisis was that between the Fed and the government, all it did was extend the pain, and it did. We never actually settled anything, and we end up having massive debt, which causes all sorts of problems down the road. Everybody will agree, you know, whether or not inflation comes back, it's not a good thing to have a country that is at 100% or more. Has a national debt of 100% or more of the size of your economy. You're injecting massive uncertainty because everybody knows down the road there is going to be a reckoning, and it's going to come in the form of some mix of inflation, higher taxes, a reduction in government benefits and government action. Uncertainty is a horrifying thing to push through the economy. And Catherine is right, like on every possible level, the way the government is doing it just turns everything to mass uncertainty. And then there is, you know, voluminous economic research that says carrying high levels, high persistent national debt relative to GDP reduces economic growth. That's what we've seen in Japan since the 1990s. It's what we're seeing in the United States for the past 20 years. And all of this stuff, all of what the Fed is doing, it was doing a version of this under Alan Greenspan and the Ben Bernanke long before the financial crisis happened. This is not sustainable. This is bleeding the patient. That's it.
I just want to talk about the fact that his answer was the closest real life answer you could give to just saying money printer Gober.
It really was.
It was like, obviously the question was not logistically, how do you produce currency? And the fact that he took refuge in that answer is purposeful obtuseness to say, well, it's digital and then we do print some of it. No, we are borrowing it from the future. And like there's a 6 or 7 different mechanisms whereby the future might wind up paying this off. And we should talk about those. But he said money printer go burr. And then and then that was allowed. And that happened in that conversation. And I don't mean to be, you know, memeifying our conversation, but that meme exists and is popular right now for a reason.
They memed them. Yeah, they meme themselves. I mean,
this is true. It definitely was a money printer go burr moment. I do think we should make a distinction here, though, between the Fed buying bonds and making putting liquidity into the market and allowing people to move their money around, which is just an important part of the way that businesses operate now. They've just got all of these loans that have all of these kind of term dates and it's kind of always rolling things over. And there's just negotiation on all of this. And if the money supply seizes up, if they can't make that happen, then everything just sort of collapses. And so the Fed is making that happen. And that is the thing that they are doing that is sort of the Friedmanite policy that they are taking, and that is different from what Congress is doing, which is just saying we don't care about debt or deficits at all, and instead are going to run up an additional $3 trillion in debt in 6 weeks. We're going to have a $4 trillion deficit this year. If we don't pass another relief bill, we're probably going to pass another relief bill, and we're going to probably end up with a $5 or $6 trillion deficit as a result.
Look, we don't all agree, but the government response, including the Federal Reserve, the response to the financial crisis was failed. The stimulus spending did not work. It was misdirected. It's useless. It just ran up a massive amount of debt. Continued quantitative easing did not achieve whatever its goal was supposed to be. And it's all premised on the idea that Hank Paulson shit his pants, that the ATM, I remember like on a Friday, he was like, if we don't do something, the ATMs won't work on the next Monday. That response didn't work. And all we're doing now is taking this in a different economy, too, because it's like the government shut down the economy. This wasn't not a naturally even a natural popping of a bubble that had been inflated up by all sorts of government policies. But if that response didn't work to the economic crisis and now we are merely doing that times 50, is that going to work? Is it just if we do it big enough, it'll work? I don't think so. And I think it's really, really problematic to say, okay, you know what? I mean, because Matt, you're right. We are all modern. We're not all modern monetary theorists. We are living in that world. And there is nobody who is saying, you know what? Like maybe the Fed shouldn't be just fucking doing whatever it wants and flooding the flooding the system with more and more money right now.
Well, Nick, that's where you're wrong, because the person saying that is Jacob Hornberger.
Okay.
Mic drop.
Yep.
Ooh, the other thing to remember, though, here is that the MMTers, if you get a little bit deep into their worldview, what they are actually arguing is that Congress should stabilize the economy through fiscal policy and should basically, and that fiscal policy rather than monetary policy should be the primary lever that policymakers use to respond to the economy. And that, and so right now what we have is both Congress and the Fed doing a bunch of stuff. And that's what we had in the Great Recession under President Obama as well. And the argument that I think, again, I think it's hard to, you know, counterfactuals are very difficult. And I don't want to say that I fully endorse this, and I definitely think it's true, but there is a pretty good argument out there that during the Great Recession, Congress did way too much. And the $1 trillion, the $900 billion stimulus that passed under Obama was a bad idea, badly executed, that probably worsened the crisis. And that at the same time, the Fed should have stepped in and done much more. And what we have right now is the Fed stepping in and doing more than it has ever done before. We also have Congress stepping in to do much more. And like I said, I have become somewhat shaken from my firm opposition to fiscal policy responses to crises, just because of the nature of this crisis. Like I said, because governments are shutting businesses down, and you can at least make an argument that they owe businesses and individuals something for having put them out of work. At the same time, what are we seeing again from Congress is that all of these relief bills are badly designed, badly structured, and then badly implemented. We have a feature coming up. Can I spoil this, Catherine? There's been plenty of reporting on this already. We've written about this, and we have a really great feature coming up by Veronique DeRougi, just looking at all of the ways that the Small Business Administration botched their role in lending out the money that they had been, the hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars that they had been assigned to lend out under the CARES Act, which was the really big relief package that passed, I believe, in March. And so in some ways, I sort of worry that just on a kind of economic policy fundamentals viewpoint, we are repeating a lot of what we did in 2008, 2009, and we'll end up with similar results, at least in the short or medium term, perhaps worse because of the scale, the larger scale of this situation relative to the Great Recession.
Well, and just really quickly, this is something that we've talked about in past podcasts, is that the thing that we are doing in response to this crisis is all the things. We are doing every single thing simultaneously. We are doing fiscal policy. We are doing monetary policy. We are opening. We are reclosing. We are opening and closing. We are wearing masks, but also distancing, but also maybe building herd immunity. We are just simultaneously doing everything. And that means that we are not going to be able to get clear lessons. We are not going to come out of this and be like, this worked, that didn't. And that's true on the kind of epidemiological level. It's true on the policy level. And, you know, when you say, well, what modern monetary theorists really want is X but not Y, like X and Y always come together because that's how our politics work.
I think the way to understand modern monetary theory is it's not guiding anything. It justifies actions that have already been taken. It's not the theory we need. It's the theory we use to explain why we've spent so much in the past and why it's okay to spend even more in the future. It has nothing to do with reality. And that might be true of monetary theory as well.
Well, there's a whole bunch of MMTers who believe that it should guide policy and that, in fact, we haven't been spending nearly enough. And this is an argument that we now hear is that Congress has not spent nearly enough money and needs to spend a huge amount more, and that it almost doesn't matter what Congress is spending that money on,
and
as long as they're just
justifying
putting money into the economy.
It justifies the past 20 years of Congress. I mean, we have not had a serious austerity program ever in the United States in the 21st century, nor are we create a theory then, or we create justifications that let us keep going on an upward slope. I find it mind-boggling, actually, that we're talking about, oh, well, you know what? What we really should do is have the Fed just jack up what it's been doing, not even for the past 20 years, we're closer to the past 40 years. And then also layer on top of that just massive unrestrained government spending. Of course, this is not going to end well. And that's not based on any kind of Hayekian or Friedmanite or Keynesian understanding. It's just you can't have a government that continues to grow and grow and grow without injecting massive amounts of uncertainty and a day of reckoning, which is just not coming.
The super powerful counterpoint to that, though, is, well, we have so far. And like, it's not my view, but it's understandable to me
that
people would be proceeding on that assumption.
That fall from 100 stories is, it's pretty painless until you hit the ground.
That's beautiful. Let's go to our end of podcasts. What you have been consuming, media-wise, entertainment-wise, nutrition-wise. Catherine, why don't you go first?
I have been doing a little bit of micro Gillespie-ing and got myself some CBD soda. And the reason that I got it is because the company is called Sweet Reason. And so yeah. I figured, got to check that out. Got to see who else is up in the Reason brand. It's pretty good. I, as I have mentioned on this podcast before, am not a tremendous fan of the cannabis products, mostly because they just make the ends of my fingers numb and my vision blurry, and that's about it. But I thought, hey, I'll give this a try. This one is, of course, in the way of our modern era. It's made from hemp, so it's fine or whatever. Like, there's always this weird way that we're talking about CBD in particular that kind of dodges around the question of, is it drugs? And this this product is no exception. It promises to deliver calm to me. That's their pitch. Curators of calm is their thing, which is just like two 2020 words close together.
What's it taste like?
It tastes so it's a La Croix type vibe. It's like somebody waved a fruit over fizzy water and that fruit like has passing acquaintance with said fizzy water. But it's
like,
pretty good.
What fruit is it? Is it like pamplemousse or something? I mean, is it
grapefruit,
crunch berries,
strawberry, lavender? The lavender in there, you know, cucumber mint. The cucumber mint is the best one of the ones I tried, but it tastes like all the products I had from the body shop in like 1996.
Tastes like those products smelled, right?
I think bong water should become a new CBD flavor.
Wasn't that a name of a band?
I'm sure it's
how many milligrams of CBD does it have? Each serving.
So in a confusing labeling decision, it claims to have 10 milligrams of hemp extract, which means I think nothing.
Yeah.
I commend to you all Mike Riggs's excellent article on commercially available CBD products. If you want to think and talk about whether or not these things are effective in available doses, I found it to be a delicious beverage with at least a nice little placebo effect, if nothing else.
Is the can made out of hemp, I hope?
It's in swanky bottles, and they're very pretty, and so they look nice on your shelf, if that's something that matters to you, if you are a curated millennial. So, Sweet Reason, I give it a meh review.
Nick, what kind of micro Gillespie-ing have you been doing?
Oh, I watched the second season of Dead to Me, which is a show on Netflix starring Christina Applegate, Linda Cardellini, who people might remember as Velma from the live-action Scooby-Doo movies a few years ago, and James Marsden in a bravura double role where he takes a page from John Astin in the movie Candy and plays twins. And it's a soap opera set in Laguna Beach, California, where Christina Applegate's husband is killed in a car accident. He's run over. And Christina Applegate becomes friends with the woman who was in the car that ran him over. And then kind of complexity ensues from that. And it's one of those shows which is, I find myself interested in these in lockdown, shows where they're claustrophobic and you realize that the scenarios are getting darker and darker and weirder and more closed off. And I don't know, I've given up on believing in catharsis. So it's kind of just, it takes, their situation is so much shittier than ours writ large. It's kind of relief for the 8 or 10 or 12 hours of the show. But Dead to Me on Netflix, enjoyable.
Peter, what's dead to you?
I have been reading and finally finished Robert Harris's novel Fatherland. It is an alternate history detective story set in 1964 in Germany, in a world in which the Nazis won World War II. Germany and the United States are on the brink of a kind of treaty situation where relations are going to be cooled between them. The United States is in the background funding the Soviets, who are in this world, like kind of not quite good guys, but like the United States has made them their allies because they are fighting the proxy war against the Nazis in Europe. And it's set in a sort of advanced Nazi society in which things have, I don't want to say fully calmed down, but things are no longer in constant upheaval. Instead, the kind of the Nazi worldview has just settled in and everyone has sort of accepted it. And one of the things that looms over all of this is the question of where did all the Jews go? And people just sort of say, they answer, oh, you know, they were all, you know, moved. They were all moved east. It was part of a process. And they don't, and then they talk, like, they don't talk. They will think to themselves, that's not a question we are going to pursue because we just don't pursue those questions. And so it's a murder mystery, like I said, and the main character is a German police detective. And of course, in this world, the entire German police have been kind of bureaucratically reorganized under the SS. A lot of the kind of major figures from Nazi Germany who you would know are still alive and in power. This is set in 1964 in part because it's on the eve of Hitler's like 50th year of reign or birthday, or I forget which, it doesn't matter. And it is a gripping, totally chilling book about the way in which bureaucracies exist to make people comfortable with moral horror and how societies can kind of just choose to be indifferent to the most outrageous and horrific events. And it's also, I mean, it's just like a super, super thrilling, excellently paced, you know, like read it in just a few days kind of novel. Robert Harris's Fatherland, highly recommended.
Is that book just basically an extended Nazi-laden version of Ursula Le Guin's The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas?
Oh, man, I don't know. I haven't read that, Le Guin.
Oh, my God. It's the best short story. Everyone listening to this podcast should go read it right now. It is about this same quandary of questions that societies don't ask.
What if they're driving, Catherine? What if they're driving? Should they wait?
I'm sure there's an audiobook. I'm sure that the computer will read it to you because this is 2020.
That's true.
Although nobody's driving anymore, right? Like, yeah. Are we all just
there's
sheltering
nowhere to
in
go,
place?
Nick.
In our...
Nope. God, I'm driving. Got a car. I'm driving.
Congratulations,
I will.
Matt.
Yeah. Thank you. It's a sweet. Like, literally almost everybody I know, which isn't very many people, and it has the exception of Nick, but everyone I know in Brooklyn, let's say, is just like openly buying cars. This is the response.
Not on the black market. They're not pretending.
Are they wearing
not to.
Masks though, Matt? That's all I care about.
You know, masks and gloves. They deliver to you. You know, and they even have like a little wipe on the car key when they dropped off the. Off the car for us this weekend. It was great. So in addition to consuming cars, I consumed the end of The Last Dance, which I talked about at the beginning of it. This is the ESPN documentary of Michael Jordan. Flawed and very compelling, propaganda for the great 1990s athlete. He had sign-off ability to it. It's a retelling of the 1997-98 season, which is the last of the Chicago Bulls six championships seasons. And the team broke up and actually Jordan retired after that season. But it was it ends up being a overall retelling of Michael Jordan's career and the Bulls six championship run. I kind of loved it with its curated flaws, because even the guy who is sitting there trying to kind of burnish an image that you wouldn't think needs to be reburnished, and you could see that he's still sort of tense over or conflicted by the fact that his happy-go-lucky, you know, pitchman persona in ads for Nike and everything else, there was a gap between the Space Jam star and just like the ruthless competitive jerkbag that he was. But like, I think most of people who were in the sports consuming society knew this in the 1990s already. He's still like torn up about it. You know, even a propaganda exercise reveals Michael Jordan to be an unhappy miserable, hyper-competitive person, and it makes me like him more. And that also makes me like him more that there's a lot of kind of lefty response to this. Is like, you know, this illustrates the problems with late capitalism. And I'm like, yeah, it does. I love late capitalism. You know, just the insane drive to win at all costs just fills my heart with a special kind of glee. All right, that's it. That's all we got. Dancing time for here. Stay tuned to all Reason podcast products. Go to reason.com/podcasts, and we'll catch you next week. Goodbye.